This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A hotter world doesn't just melt polar glaciers faster, raising sea levels around the world. New science says melting glaciers lead to a hotter world. Plus, episodes of glaciers and ice shelves falling into the sea can make the weather one year very different from the next. From New Zealand, ice expert Nicholas Golich joins us. But first, from California, Dr. Robert Allen reveals pollution has hidden up to half a degree C of warming. I think the 2-degree supposed safe line is already in the rearview mirror. This is Radio EcoShock. Prepare to live in a very different world. It is already pretty strange. Talking with CKUW Radio in Winnipeg, Canada, a weak jet stream left the freezer door open. After a few weeks getting down to minus 39.9 degrees C, about the same in Fahrenheit, folks there are ready for some global warming. Where Tasmania was super hot with giant fires, it snowed in the highlands a few days later, just like the strange snow in Hawaii last week. California has been drowning in rain, atmospheric rivers, and that turns to mega snow in the mountains, while the slopes burned out in last year's fires break into rivers of mud, taking out homes and highways. Back in Australia, following that brutal heat, a mega river up to 37 miles wide, 60 kilometers, suddenly appeared in the bed of a smallish river in Queensland. Folks in the Swiss and Austrian Alps are digging out of mountains of snow. That all is in the neutral ocean conditions, but scientists have just announced a new tilt. El Niño has formed in the eastern Pacific. That usually leads to more record hot weather around the world. Prediction is pretty hard. The future has been destabilized. You can't see them, but you are surrounded by billions of tiny particles. When bits of dust or droplets hang in the air, scientists call them aerosols. In the atmosphere, aerosols protect us a little bit from being too hot. As smog, they kill us by the millions every year. What happens to aerosols as the world heats up even more? We need to know. Our guest, Dr. Robert Allen, wades into what may be one of the most complex questions of science. After getting his PhD in atmosphere, ocean, and climate dynamics at Yale, Robert was a postdoctoral scholar at various places, including at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. We have called Dr. Allen about his new paper, Enhanced Land-Sea Warming Contrast Elevates Aerosol Pollution in a Warmer World. From the University of California, Dr. Allen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Bob, when you're out in public, how do you explain what an aerosol is?
I describe it as basically a suspension of fine particles in the atmosphere. They could be liquid or solid, but from a climate standpoint, we're more interested in the solid particles because they have an impact on Earth's energy balance, which has important implications for the climate system of the planet. And they also have an impact on human health. When we talk about aerosols, we usually break them down into two different categories. We have anthropogenic aerosol, man-made aerosol. And these are things like your sulfates, your nitrates, your organic aerosol. And then we also have natural aerosols, which are kind of emitted, for the most part, independent of humans. And natural aerosols constitute basically dust and sea salt.
When sunlight arrives on Earth, some of it bounces and radiates back out into space, but some of the sun's energy is held within the Earth's atmosphere by greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide. And a significant portion of the sun's light never reaches the surface because it strikes aerosols first. What happens up there?
Yeah, so these aerosol particles, like I mentioned before, impact Earth's energy balance. And aerosols generally absorb or reflect sunlight. So depending on the aerosol species, so for example, sulfate aerosol is basically 100% scattering aerosol, whereas maybe like a black carbon aerosol is one of the anthropogenic aerosol species that actually absorbs sunlight. So the mixture of these various anthropogenic aerosols ultimately results in less sunlight reaching the surface of our planet, and that has a net cooling effect. So overall, we think these anthropogenic aerosols have had an overall cooling impact on the planet, and they've essentially offset some of the warming that we would have expected from the increase in greenhouse gases.
they've kind of hidden our real situation.
Yes, this is true. It turns out that we've been running a bit of a geoengineering experiment, even though we haven't really acknowledged it, in that we've been emitting greenhouse gases, which cause warming of the planet, and is the major focus of climate change. But then we've also been emitting these anthropogenic aerosol particles, which has a bit of a, it kind of counters some of the warming that we would have gotten from the increase in greenhouse gases. So obviously, aerosols are a bit complicated because on one hand, they've offset some of the warming that we would have received. But on the other hand, aerosols have a negative impact on human health. We want to clean up the atmosphere from aerosols and air pollution to mitigate premature death. But if we do that, that's going to basically exacerbate greenhouse gas-induced global warming.
So maybe this is a foolish question, but why don't the greenhouse gases capture the energy reflected by aerosols in the lower atmosphere?
So greenhouse gases and aerosols interact with different parts of electromagnetic radiation. So greenhouse gases primarily absorb longer wave radiation that our planet is basically re-emitting back to space. Aerosol particles, on the other hand, do not really interact with this long-wave terrestrial radiation. They primarily interact with the solar radiation that is coming into our climate system. So greenhouse gases basically don't interact with shortwave solar energy like the aerosols do.
Well, we have a general number for the number of parts per million of carbon dioxide, and lately the latest reading I saw was 414 parts per million, which is very concerning. Do we have a general number for the amount of global dimming caused by aerosols preventing that light from reaching the ground or the seas?
Yeah, we do. Basically, the emission of anthropogenic aerosols peaked in the 1970s and 1980s. And over this, 1970, 1980 time frame, I think some estimates of the amount of global dimming are on the order of, 3 or 4 watts per meter squared for the Northern Hemisphere. And that, in turn, has been implicated in reducing Northern Hemisphere precipitation over this time frame, and it's possibly also associated with the devastating drought that the Sahel experienced in the 1970s and 1980s. Since the 70s and 80s, the United States and Europe in particular have implemented some air pollution policies that have resulted in a decrease in anthropogenic aerosol emissions. However, this has kind of been outweighed to some extent from a global perspective by continued increases, more enhanced increases, I should say, in parts of Asia, China and India in particular.
All right. We're ready to talk about the new paper, Enhanced Land-Sea Warming Contrast Elevates Aerosol Pollution in a Warmer World, where you are the lead author, and it was published February 4th, 2019, in the prestigious journal Nature Climate Change. Now, there's a stunning statement in the introduction which says, quote, aerosols cause a net cooling effect which probably has offset about 40% of greenhouse gas warming, unquote. And that's half the real warming potential getting shielded by pollution, if I'm reading it right, both man-made and natural. Does that mean we've created warming that is really 40% worse than we are experiencing so far, or does it imply a change in time, putting off the arrival of the heat? I don't really understand what that figure means.
That figure of 40% is referring to the fact that we've offset approximately 40% of the warming that we should have felt due to the increase in greenhouse gases, simply due to the fact that we've been co-emitting anthropogenic aerosols, which have resulted in a net cooling effect due to their enhanced reflection of incoming sunlight. The implication of this is that, again, if we were to try to clean up the atmosphere and improve air quality, that implies a reduction in these anthropogenic aerosol emissions, which implies a reduction in this cooling effect that we've implemented over the 20th century. And that, in turn, suggests that greenhouse gas-induced climate change and global warming will accelerate. I mean, there's been a couple of recent studies that have come out where they've basically, in a climate model, you can kind of run some idealized simulations, and they ask the question, well, if we remove all anthropogenic aerosol species from this climate model, how much does the planet warm? They looked at a couple different models because there's some uncertainty in the aerosol effects on the climate system, and they found something like 0.5 to 1 degree C of warming if we completely remove all anthropogenic aerosol species. So that's a massive number. right now the planet's warmed about 1 degree C over the 20th century due to the increase in greenhouse gases. So this offsetting effect that aerosols have is very significant.
It sure is. And I know you published about my next question back in 2010 with Australia's Stephen Sherwood. What is the share of total aerosol shielding coming from natural sources and how much from human activity?
I guess if you were to compare the amount of anthropogenic aerosol in the atmosphere versus the amount of natural aerosol, the amount of natural aerosol is much, much larger than the amount of anthropogenic aerosol, by probably several times larger. But the important thing here from a climate change standpoint is the change in these aerosol species over time. Over the 20th century, the increase in anthropogenic aerosol emissions has been very large, and the change in natural aerosol emissions has generally assumed to be essentially very small. So it's the change that we're most concerned with when we're referring to the climate change impacts of aerosol.
And can scientists further break down how much of these aerosols come from, say, burning fossil fuels like cars, trucks, planes, and ships, and how much from other human activities like farming or agrochemicals or land use changes?
That depends on the anthropogenic aerosol species that you're concerned with. Something like a sulfate aerosol, for example, which forms in the atmosphere through the oxidation of sulfur dioxide. Most SO2 is emitted by fossil fuel power plants that primarily use coal as their main fossil fuel energy source. When you're talking about something like a black carbon aerosol, it's about 40% biomass burning, so things like savanna clearing and deforestation. And the remaining 60% is due to fossil fuels, primarily things like diesel engines, for example. But there's also biofuel. Biofuel is another large component of black carbon emissions. A lot of people living in developing countries still use wood as their primary source to heat their home or cook their food, and that results in a large emissions of these black carbon aerosols.
Oh, boy. I'm heating with wood, so I'm contributing, too. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, they use a figure of 0.9 watts per meter squared for radiative forcing from aerosols. And the uncertainty range, though, is huge. The IPCC suggests the radiative forcing could be twice as much or one-ninth as much as their 0.9 figure. So have scientists narrowed that range since, and does that uncertainty greatly affect the results of your paper?
Yeah, this is one of the frustrating aspects if you're in the game of climate science and trying to understand the effects of aerosols on the climate system, is that aerosols, as well as clouds, are the main uncertainties for understanding the climate system and human perturbations to the climate system. The uncertainty range hasn't really decreased very much, so that's a bit sobering. A lot of it has to do with the very complicated interactions that these submicron-sized particles have on the climate system. And I think another component of this is that there are multiple interactions and feedbacks within the climate system that make it very difficult to understand how, you know, a submicron particle can have an impact on this much larger system. In the context of my study, the uncertainty in the radiative forcing of aerosols is not particularly important, because we weren't focused on trying to understand the radiative effects of these aerosols. We were just focused on trying to understand how climate change impacts the amount of aerosol in the atmosphere.
And what did you find?
Well, we found that if you assume kind of a business-as-usual scenario where we continue combusting greenhouse gases at the current rate, you keep anthropogenic aerosol emissions fixed at, say, a present-day value, by the end of the century, the burden of anthropogenic aerosols will increase in response to this greenhouse gas-induced warming.
That's kind of strange, because we know that, for example, in China, people are trying to clean up the air, and yet you're saying that the conditions from climate change will actually lead towards an increase of aerosols. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So you can think of the amount of aerosol in the atmosphere, it's primarily a function of your emissions, but then it's also a function of other processes operating in the atmosphere, including transport and removal. So when you perturb the climate system, for example, you warm it through an increase in greenhouse gases, then that impacts the atmospheric circulation, the winds, the precipitation patterns, the relative humidity, and those in turn have an impact on the transport of aerosols and their removal. And what we found is a relatively robust response, particularly in the northern hemisphere mid-latitudes, where these continents warm up at a faster rate than the corresponding ocean surface, and this promotes enhanced continental aridity, so basically enhanced drying of the continents. And this drying is linked to several climate parameters, including decreases in soil moisture, decreases in relative humidity, but we also found a decrease in what we call large-scale precipitation. And most of these aerosol species, the dominant removal mechanism is, in fact, precipitation. So if you reduce the amount of precipitation, you effectively reduce the amount of removal of these aerosol species. And that's ultimately what we argue is driving the increase in aerosol burden in response to future warming.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Robert Allen from the University of California, Riverside. We're talking about how new science projecting how pollution will behave in a hotter world. Your paper, Bob, in Nature Climate Change says the latest models show a greater shielding of Earth from the sun during the hottest times of the year in the Northern Hemisphere summer. For those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, isn't that a good thing, helping to shade us from what would be the worst of the heat?
That is a good thing, in that, yes, these aerosols have a net negative impact on the energy balance of the planet, which would result in surface cooling. But this effect is going to be much, much, much smaller than the warming perturbation due to the increase in greenhouse gases. And maybe more importantly, as I mentioned earlier, these aerosols not only impact the climate system, but they have a negative impact on human health.
As you know, we're experiencing more extreme precipitation events, whether it's dumps of snow like we're getting where I am right now, or inches of rain. And this is happening all over the world. The IPCC released a special report saying extreme precipitation events will increase as the world heats up. Won't that extra rain wash out even more pollution, revealing the true heat from the emissions we've released?
That's a good question, and that's a bit of a subtlety on the effects of precipitation on removal of these aerosol particles. It's generally thought that if you increase the intensity of rainfall, that's not necessarily going to result in enhanced removal of these aerosol species, because the process becomes saturated at a certain level of rainfall intensity, that increasing the intensity of rainfall above this threshold doesn't result in a net increase in aerosol removal. And there have been a couple studies that have looked at this, and it's basically a distinction between the intensity of precipitation and the frequency of precipitation. And it may be the case that the frequency of precipitation is more important in dictating the removal of these aerosol species than the intensity.
Could you tell us a bit more about the dominant driver that you found that you call the land-sea warming contrast? What is that? Take whatever time you need to explain that for us, would you?
Yeah, it's a very fundamental result in climate change. It's supported by model simulations, and it's supported by kind of fundamental theory. And basically, it just involves when you increase greenhouse gases, the land warms more than the corresponding oceans. So that's what the land-sea warming contrast is. And it has a couple different ways it can be explained. In terms of the ocean, the oceans have greater thermal inertia than do the continents. So, for example, they can transport some of the heat that they absorb to depth, thereby creating the surface less warm than it otherwise would be. But there are other processes involved that are probably more important, and it has to do with the fact that there are moisture limitations over land, whereas these same moisture limitations obviously don't exist over the ocean. So one of the fundamental quantities that we often use to try to better understand the land-sea warming contrast is the breakdown between sensible and latent heating. And over the ocean, like I said, you basically have an unlimited amount of moisture, so a lot of the incoming energy can go into evaporation. And that, by definition, it's latent energy. It doesn't manifest itself in terms of a change in temperature. But over the continents, where moisture is more limited, more of the incoming energy can go into sensible heating. So that's one explanation. And there are a few others involving differences in boundary layer, land-sea contrast, and lapse rates. And there are also considerations involving changes in relative humidity between the land and the ocean. Yeah, it's basically just the land warms up at a faster rate than does the ocean.
A few weeks ago, we talked with the young scientist Yang-Yang Shu at Texas A&M. And he found, looking at the attempted cleanup of pollution in China, that Local meteorological conditions would likely encourage even more smog despite that cleanup effort. For example, there'd be more stagnation days and the precipitation might increase, but there would be more dry days in between that. Does that basically agree with what your study found?
Yeah, that's a similar argument as what we are proposing. I guess stagnation has a component that's related to precipitation, as you mentioned, but it also has a component related to wind speeds. So if you have a decrease in, say, upper level or surface wind speeds, then that promotes the accumulation of aerosol particles in that region, which obviously leads to a reduction in air quality. Some of these aerosol particles form through reactions within the atmosphere. So as the conditions for stagnation, if they were to increase, then there would be more time for these precursor particles to react with other aerosol species and sunlight to form these secondary organic aerosols. So it's generally arguing along the same lines as what we are.
Robert Allen, let's break off for a minute to discuss something I learned from your previous paper in 2012. I should have known this, but I didn't know that the tropics are expanding north and south as the world warms. You say it's not directly caused by greenhouse gas emissions, but something else. What is causing the tropics to expand, and how do we know that?
Yeah, this is a topic of intense research, actually. The causes of tropical expansion are multiple. There are multiple explanations, and it also depends on the hemisphere, northern hemisphere versus southern hemisphere. I want to start off by saying that greenhouse gases do cause the tropics to widen, but there are other components. I argue that these absorbing aerosols, the black carbon aerosols that we previously discussed, are a driver of tropical widening in the northern hemisphere. And in the southern hemisphere, the depletion of stratospheric ozone has also been implicated in the polar expansion of the tropical belt in the southern hemisphere.
Well, this isn't a little thing. I mean, you cite a 2008 paper by Seidel et al., and you suggest the tropics expanded by somewhere between 2 to 5 degrees of latitude since 1979, not that long ago. And I used rough back-of-the-envelope calculations at the high end of 5 degrees latitude. That moves the tropics about 350 miles or 550 kilometers closer to most of my listeners. That must have huge implications for humans and the planet.
Yeah, so the Seidel paper that you refer to was kind of one of the first manuscripts that discussed this idea that the tropics were widening. The number you quote, 2 to 5 degrees of latitude of widening, was a very preliminary calculation. And there's been a lot of subsequent follow-on studies that have tried to use additional observational data sets to quantify the rate at which the tropics have been widening. And it's generally thought that it's probably on the lower side of that range, so something more like 2 degrees. And a recent publication that I was just looking at was quoting a rate of tropical widening of about 0.5 degrees latitude per decade since 1979. So again, that's about 2 degrees total widening.
That's about 140 miles maybe of widening since 1979 at the low end.
Yeah, and the implications of tropical widening, from my perspective, the main implication is basically an expansion of the subtropical dry zone. This is kind of the place on the planet where we have most of the world's deserts, and it's due to kind of the subsiding branch of the Hadley circulations in both hemispheres. And as we continue to warm the planet and the boundaries of the tropical edge moves further poleward, you can think of that as an expansion of these subtropical dry zones. That's probably the biggest implication in terms of an impact on humans and the ecosystem.
Now, on your webpage, a description of your research introduces another unsettling complexity to this already tough problem of aerosols. You talk about a process where aerosols have an indirect effect of reducing cloud formation. Could you explain that for us?
Yeah, just to back up a second, you know, this is why quantification of the radiative impacts of aerosols is so difficult and why the uncertainty is so large. They generally have three different impacts. They have what we call these direct effects, which I've been previously describing as the scattering and absorption of solar radiation. Aerosol particles also serve as cloud condensation nuclei, so they have indirect impacts on clouds through changes in cloud microphysics. It's thought that an increase in aerosol particles makes clouds brighter, enhancing the albedo of our planet. They probably also lead to a suppression of precipitation, but it depends on the type of cloud. If you're looking at convective cloud, these aerosol microphysical effects may actually invigorate convection. And then there's an additional way in which aerosols can impact the climate system are these semi-direct effects, whereby an absorbing aerosol, like this black carbon aerosol, heats the atmospheric column, which results in a reduction in the relative humidity and decreases the cloud cover. But it turns out that there are multiple semi-direct effects that are dependent on kind of the co-location of the black carbon and the cloud. So this cloud desiccation effect that I was just referring to is kind of the situation where the black carbon and the cloud are co-located. But if black carbon is actually, say, above like a low-lying cloud, like a marine stratocumulus, then that actually could result in the opposite effect, where you have an increase in cloud cover. This is why reducing the uncertainty in aerosol effects on the climate system is difficult, and why the uncertainty kind of remains relatively large today.
Yeah, we talked to another atmospheric scientist, Tim Garrett, who said clouds are really almost the frontier of science still. It's so hard to nail down how mists and smoke and invisible particles move around, especially in an uncertain future with climate change. There must be a lot of known unknowns, and do you expect surprises still to come?
Possibly. I mean, I guess in terms of the main areas of uncertainty when it comes to understanding the aerosol impacts on the climate system generally have to do with their impacts on clouds. Most of the uncertainty in aerosol impacts on the climate system are directly related to their impacts on cloud microphysics. Another significant source of uncertainty has to do with the vertical profile of these aerosols, particularly the absorbing aerosols. Because like I mentioned before, if you're interested in trying to understand these semi-direct effects, the vertical co-location of the absorbing aerosol relative to the cloud is important. But if we don't know where the black carbon is in a vertical atmospheric column, then that makes it difficult to quantify this effect. And a lot of these uncertainties have to do with the fact that it's very difficult to observe clouds and aerosols out in the real world. And when it comes to something like a satellite, for example, the main quantity that we observe through satellites is something called the aerosol optical depth. And that is basically just a vertically integrated quantity that tells you something about the amount of sunlight that the aerosol is scattering or absorbing. So it doesn't really tell us anything about the type of aerosol or where the aerosol is located vertically and where that aerosol is located relative to the clouds. So there's a lot of uncertainties. I think a lot of these uncertainties can be reduced by improved observational measurements and probably some finer scale type modeling where we incorporate more of these microphysical effects, like a cloud resolving model, for example.
Bob Allen, are you personally worried about climate change? Do you think we're going to see some serious times in the future because we're not acting in time?
I am concerned about climate change on many levels. I think that some of the more negative impacts, for example, sea level rise, changes in vector-borne diseases like malaria and dengue. We had like a Zika outbreak that I'd never heard of 2 years ago that actually impacted places in the United States, like Miami, for example. Possible, you know, international conflicts, environmental refugees, more extreme weather events like hurricanes, for example. These are all very scary. And, you know, even the United States, you know, I live in Southern California in California, and, you know, we've had some pretty big natural disasters over the last couple of years. We had a massive wildfire a few months ago, Paradise, California. It's the largest wildfire in California's history. These are all concerns. They're very significant concerns, and you know, we're going down a path that I don't want to continue going down. Unfortunately, the United States is kind of dragging its feet right now. So,
well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time, but I know that the science that you're doing will help us at least picture what we're dealing with, and maybe that will be a first step towards some sort of solution. We've been speaking with Dr. Robert Allen, climatologist and associate professor at UC Riverside. We've been talking about the paper Enhanced Land-Sea Warming Contrast Elevates Aerosol Pollution in a Warmer World, published in Nature Climate Change. I will put links to all the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Bob, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
New science predicts chaotic climate with bigger changes in temperatures year to year. Our next guest told Scientific American, quote, "This unpredictability is going to prove extremely disruptive for all of us and will make adaptation and planning much more difficult," end quote. And the driver for all of that comes from the furthest ends of the Earth. It's not what you would expect. We're going to talk about ice melt on Antarctica and Greenland, and yes, that will affect you. There is also a small sliver of possibly better news. The most apocalyptic predictions for sea level rise may not happen. Our guest, Nicholas Gollidge, is lead author of one paper just published in Nature and co-author of another. He has 68 more peer-reviewed scientific papers to his credit. Educated in Scotland, Associate Professor Nick Gollidge is currently with the Antarctic Research Center, and that's at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. From Wellington, Nick, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
So I gather it's been a crazy busy week for you, Nick, with the media calling from all over the world?
It was very busy last week, yeah. So it's nice that we got a lot of coverage. So, yeah, very happy about that.
It's an important story. Now, you begin your new work by assuming that despite the aims of the Paris Agreement, the global mean temperature will exceed the alleged safe limits, going towards 2.6, maybe even to 4 degrees C beyond pre-industrial. Why do you think that's a scenario that you should work with?
Those numbers basically come from the Climate Action Tracker, which is an online resource which uses climate model scenarios to basically forecast the range of warming that we're likely to reach by 2100, taking into account the various government pledges. It's a dynamic website that they update periodically as governments either improve or remove some of their climate pledges. So that number has kind of changed a little bit over the last couple of years because of electoral changes in some countries. But yeah, for the last year or two, it's been fairly set on predicting more than 3 degrees warming by 2100.
And we won't mention any names like the United States or Brazil and all that. Okay, so when the governments met in Katowice, Poland in December 2018, did the projections given to them by international scientists include the impacts of ice sheet discharge?
Well, of course, I can't say specifically what was given to them, but I think globally most policymakers are still using predictions from the last IPCC assessment, the AR5 assessment, which was completed in 2013. I know for sure that none of the climate models that were used in that assessment included the effects of ice sheet melt. Now, of course, the IPCC was tasked with delivering some special reports, which are beginning to come online now. So in some of those reports, they may be at least referring to some of the literature which talks about these effects. But there's always this sort of slight latency between, you know, when we do the science and how quickly that can get into, you know, both into publication and into big documents like IPCC assessments. So it's partly just fault of the process. And, you know, I think as scientists and communicators, we actually need to find faster mechanisms to get our message to decision makers.
Well, there's a couple of things we need to talk about here. One is the changes in ocean currents that could destabilize the weather, especially in the Northern Hemisphere. And then there's sea level rise, and I'd like to start with that. On Radio EcoShock, at least a dozen scientists have said sea level rise, not heat, will be the great game changer emerging out of a shifting climate. And it's, you know, about disappearing port cities, millions of people displaced, agricultural problems, and so on. But the predictions for sea level rise by 2100 have been all over the place, Nick. They run from a low of just 30 centimeters, or about 1 foot, to as much as 7 meters, or 21 feet. Nick, why is there such a difference, all coming from pretty good scientists?
Yeah, this is something that people rightly pick up on. And I think we need to break this down into some of the individual components. You know, when we think about global mean sea level rise, What we're talking about is very much an average value across the globe that comes from a range of different things. You know, we've got a thermal expansion component, which is, you know, fairly well understood, and we can kind of predict that fairly well based on predicted warming. We've got the contribution that comes from mountain glaciers and ice caps, and of course, they tend to respond fairly linearly to warming air temperature, so they're fairly predictable as well. And then we have the big problem with the ice sheets, and we've got Greenland, which generally responds to the atmosphere mainly, so it's a surface mass balance issue. So again, we can kind of predict that fairly well in terms of, you know, how it responds to a warming world. And actually, the model simulations for Greenland, there is some variability, obviously, between the models, but the ones that include dynamic contributions as well as surface melting, they give a little extra contribution to sea level, but there's not a huge difference. The real elephant in the room, as you allude to, is the Antarctic ice sheet, and particularly the dynamic contribution that comes from Antarctica. So in the last IPCC report, in AR5, they separated out the contribution that they thought would come from Antarctica based on just changes in temperature, air temperature, the surface mass balance. And then they put in an estimate for what they thought could come from rapid ice dynamics. And the reason they had to estimate it was because at the time there weren't sufficiently complex ice sheet models that could really simulate this kind of rapid ice dynamic behavior. Now, since then, the community has responded to that. We now have many more ice sheet models that can do this kind of stuff. But, you know, we're still trying to get to grips with how we deal with the processes we know about. But then there's also the wild card of processes that we, you know, we maybe know about but haven't included in models. And so some of the very high estimates that came out in 2016 were based on one particular paper that where the authors decided to put in some mechanisms that we see in Greenland but we don't see in Antarctica. And they basically scaled them up and said, wow, look at this. You know, we get huge sea level rise. Now, those authors are now bringing their numbers back down. They presented new work at AGU last year, which considerably revised downward the 2100 predictions from around a meter back down to 30 centimeters or so from Antarctica. So there's big changes there. The rest of the community are still trying to get to grips with whether it's a scheme that we need to incorporate. I mean, for sure, we need to investigate it and understand how it works, how it's likely to play out. But these are all very, very active areas of scientific research and in some cases, quite sort of heated discussion. So, yeah, I mean, it's frustrating for us as a community, I think, to find so much variability in the predictions because it kind of makes us look like we don't really know what we're doing. But actually, I'd say that over the last year or two, we're beginning to understand some of these mechanisms better. We're seeing greater convergence of predictions. So just finally, to just sort of touch on that very, very wide range of total sea levels that you mentioned, you know, what we're talking about there with these very, very high numbers, the 21 feet that you mentioned, you know, this is really the very, very upper end of the distribution. So we sort of think about sea level predictions in terms of a probability distribution. Now, if you take the very, very end of that long tail, it could be, you know, 21 feet. But actually, the median value is probably somewhere near, you know, 1 meter, you know, 3 or 4 feet, something like that.
Right. You were partly talking about a 2015 paper led by Dave Pollard and Richard Alley from Penn State. And they were talking about hydrofracture or cliff failure. And I think this comes down to an issue that I've seen in various blogs and emails, people worrying about that instead of flowing into the sea from a pressure in an orderly way, this ice might just crack off in great masses and fall into the sea. Is that kind of the picture that we're discussing here?
Absolutely. That's a nice summary. Essentially, what the authors have sort of put forward is this idea that when a glacier flows into the sea, it might not have a floating tongue like an ice shelf. It might just have a vertical cliff. And we see this a lot in Greenland, you know, some of the outlet glaciers that are flowing into fjords. They're terminating in the ocean, but they have these vertical faces. And what happens is that as the flow of the glacier, you know, accelerates their fast-flowing glaciers, you get all these longitudinal stresses. So you're basically stretching the ice out as it flows into the ocean. You get a lot of crevassing. And, of course, if you get surface melting, all that water then tends to drain into the crevasses. And it can kind of act as a wedging force. It tries to split those crevasses apart. So combined with all the other stresses that are being applied to this poor little glacier, the scenario is that these sort of marine terminating glacier margins can basically just collapse of their own accord. Now, nobody really debates that that is a real process. And, you know, when we've seen it for years and people have written about tidewater glaciers around the world for many, many decades. The issue with the 2015 and 2016 papers was whether that scheme, that mechanism is translatable to Antarctica. And if it is, then at what scale can it realistically operate? You know, it's one thing to have a grounded margin in a confined fjord that fractures and carves icebergs. But if you then whole-scale apply the same mechanism to something like the Ross Sea, where you have a floating ice shelf that's maybe, you know, 1,000 kilometers wide. If you lose that ice shelf, then you have an ice front that's a comparable width. Now, is it realistic to sort of think that that whole ice cliff would be collapsing in the same way as a narrow fjordal glacier that's maybe, you know, just a couple of tens of kilometers wide? So lots of uncertainty in that translation, and Rob DeConto and Dave Pollard were, you know, really pushing the envelope in terms of forcing the community to look at this and say, hey, you know, we need to think about this. Is this something that's going to be important? And, you know, that's how science moves forward. You know, they're absolutely right to do that. So the work that we have to do now is for more modeling groups to sort of take this on and try and implement the same process in different models, and really try and understand what are the sort of physical bounds that control these kind of mechanisms. And if we go back to using very sort of well-constrained engineering-type models to understand the stresses and strains, do we get the same results as when DeConto and Pollard use their, you know, relatively coarse resolution whole continent ice sheet model? So, you know, lots of work to be done to really understand that.
For those keeping score at home, we're talking about, you can get an update from the paper Revisiting Antarctic Ice Loss Due to Marine Ice Cliff Instability, as published February 6, 2019 in the journal Nature. The lead author is Dr. Tasman Edwards from King's College London, with Nick, our guest, as a co-author. So we know, Nick, that the sea is not really level, and sea level rise will not be evenly distributed. As the ice sheets melt, where will the highest waters pile up, and where will the sea level actually go down?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. You know, we always sort of blindly assume that, you know, as you sort of put water into the ocean, it just sort of fills up like a bathtub. But of course, there's lots of competing factors that complicate that pattern. And because of the rotation of the Earth and the changing gravitational attraction of these ice sheets, when they lose mass, basically because they're smaller, they exert a reduced gravitational pull on the ocean surface. So actually the water tends to drop away from the ice sheets because of the rotation and the reduced gravitational effects from the ice sheets. Most of the water tends to pile up in the mid-latitudes, particularly in the central Pacific. So we start seeing, you know, this bulge in the sea level, something like 1.4 times the global mean in the mid-latitude areas, particularly sort of central Pacific and so on. So, you know, near to New Zealand, we obviously have a lot of our population come from the Southwest Pacific Islands, which are very low-lying, very vulnerable to that kind of enhanced sea level rise. For people in the U.S., they might be thinking more about friends and relatives in Hawaii, places like that, you know, although, you know, the mountains in Hawaii are protected to some extent from sea level rise. You know, a lot of the development is on the low ground near to the coast. So, you know, those places are going to be sort of disproportionately affected. Unfortunately, the areas where we're going to see lower sea levels are generally the areas where people don't live. So it's not even as though we can benefit greatly from that. So the closer you get to the ice sheet, the lower the sea levels is going to be. So, you know, around the Antarctic Peninsula, around West Antarctica, you might see a lowering of sea level, but that's not really going to going to help populations globally, unfortunately.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Nick Golage from the Antarctic Research Center in Wellington, New Zealand. We're talking about ice sheet melt in Antarctica and Greenland and how that could reshape our world. Let's move on to the other paper published in Nature on February 6th. The title is Global Environmental Consequences of 21st Century Ice Sheet Melt. What motivated you, Nick, to do this research?
This work came out of previous studies where we had looked at the Antarctic ice sheet, how it was going to change in a warmer world. And in 2015, we published a paper which was very much focused on the very long-term commitments that come from global warming. So this idea that, you know, as we warm the climate, we might be able to stabilize the climate at some point, but we set in motion a whole series of changes that are going to play out over hundreds, if not thousands of years. So we did that work in 2015 and sort of on the back of that started realizing that although that was kind of interesting scientifically, it was very hard to sort of communicate the urgency of climate change to people when you're talking thousands of years in the future. So there was kind of a need in my mind to sort of revisit that work and think more specifically about doing predictions for the present century, and also to think about doing both ice sheets. So in the past, I'd only looked at Antarctica. This time around, I wanted to look at the Greenland ice sheet as well. And because we chose to focus really just on this century, it did give us the advantage that we could run the models at a higher resolution. So the computational costs of, you know, going to high resolution mean that it's very hard to do long simulations. But if you're only interested in, you know, a century or two, then it becomes tractable. So that was kind of the driver for me to sort of start the ice sheet simulations. But I'd also been involved in a number of different studies over the years where we'd sort of looked at and investigated this interesting sort of feedback mechanism where meltwater from the ice sheets affects ocean circulation and in turn affects the atmosphere. So that was something that I was kind of keen to do as well, because up until now, nearly all the publications that have looked at these kind of interactions have always done that in a very conceptual way. It's always been kind of like, oh, let's take X amount of meltwater and a climate state of this, and we'll just put the two together and see what happens. I wanted to kind of redo that in a scenario-based way. So I thought, you know, we're doing the ice sheet simulations according to these representative concentration pathways, the IPCC climate scenarios. I thought we're in a perfect position now to use the outputs from those ice simulations to drive some climate simulations that can tell us about scenario-based climate perturbations. So those were kind of two parts of the study, and they sort of basically formed a kind of natural alliance in my mind. So that's kind of where we went with that.
Reading the two new papers, I got a small enlightenment, I think, but I could be off base. I'm not a scientist, but previously, most of my guests talked about the impact of warmer temperatures in the air and the ocean and how that would affect ice melt in Greenland and Antarctica. But it seems to me your team is saying the opposite almost. Ice melt will affect air temperatures and ocean currents. So is that a feedback, or is that just the way this planet constantly interacts from both ends?
It's a complicated planet, isn't it? We live in a world where we have so many complex interactions, and you know, as scientists, particularly as modelers, we're sort of trying to take apart the system and say, you know, what influences what? And of course, everything's interlinked so tightly that it's very hard to sort of find a starting point and say, well, let's start with this thing and see how it affects the other thing, because that other thing then affects something else, which then comes back to the first thing. So we sort of acknowledge that sort of interconnected aspects of the Earth system, and I guess what we try and do in most modeling experiments is try to sort of understand just one part of the puzzle. So we kind of know, I think, fairly well how, you know, changes in the atmosphere and changes in the ocean lead to changes in the ice sheet, but there's not been as much work done looking at, you know, how changes in the ice sheet affect the ocean and atmospheres.
The new paper resurrects another debate that's been going on for quite a long time. Many of us saw the movie The Day After Tomorrow. It shows North America rapidly freezing over, basically because the warm Gulf Stream stops flowing north. And scientists came out and quashed that as sci-fi and forget about it. But in fact, many in the scientific community have been saying nothing significant will happen to the North Atlantic overturning circulation, as scientists refer to it, for centuries to come. Your new paper stirs it up, suggesting we will see noticeable changes to those warming currents, even during this century. What's up?
You know, in the last couple of years, there is definitely more and more evidence that the strength of that overturning circulation has decreased in recent times. So it's something that we can observe. It's no longer a kind of what if. I mean, we know that it's weakening. I guess the question on most people's minds is, you know, will the weakening continue? Will it accelerate? Will we reach this point where it collapses? You know, one of the key things about the AMOC, this overturning circulation, is that it's a system that has been known for a long time to be essentially sort of, you know, bistable. You know, it can exist in its current state, or if it's perturbed enough, if we disrupt it enough, it can basically collapse. By that, we mean that the strength of the overturning reduces very, very rapidly to a point where the ocean circulation is in a very different kind of mode than it is now. And the interesting thing here is that this is a threshold type system. So we're working in a space where you can kind of gradually keep nudging something. It's kind of like pushing a boulder further and further towards the cliff edge. At some point, you get to a point where it just drops off the cliff. And that's what happens with the AMOC. You can push it and push it and push it, and then bang, it collapses. So depending on which models you look at, you might find that point of collapse might differ slightly. But we kind of know it's that sort of system, so that's why people are worried about it. I guess when people have done climate model simulations, ocean model simulations, they haven't included the ice sheet melt. And yet we know that there's this big sort of cold blob in the ocean around Greenland because of the meltwater coming off the ice sheet. So we know the meltwater is going in there, and we know that it's likely to be having an effect on the overturning circulation. And so it kind of seems, you know, at least consistent that in our simulations, we see a 15% reduction in the strength of the overturning, I think, you know, starting around the mid-century and only taking a few decades, which is quite kind of scary. So the question then is, you know, does 15% reduction matter? You know, we've seen a 15% reduction in strength over the last few decades. You know, if this adds to it, then we've got, you know, 30% reduction. How much further do we have to push it before we get to that collapse state? So, you know, it's an area that sparks a lot of interest and a lot of debate. And one of the reasons is, of course, because, you know, we're talking about a huge system here. I mean, we can observe sort of tiny fractions of it, but really we rely on numerical models to understand it. And, of course, the best way to understand it from a numerical model is to run lots and lots of different models and have lots of different groups doing this kind of thing. So the more that we do that, the more we get a sense of what a robust, you know, realistic response will be. So I'd say, you know, the work we've done is enough to kind of flag it as a warning.
Well, there's another warning in the paper talking about climate chaos from ice sheet melt, which is something we wouldn't normally think about. The new paper says, quote, "Perhaps more immediately impactful than gradual warming is the possibility of enhanced interannual temperature variability, which would result in more widespread or more frequent terrestrial and marine heat waves." How could the process of melting ice at the poles increase the size or frequency of heat waves in the lands where we live?
Yeah, it's difficult to sort of track these things to sort of individual events or processes. I guess what we're seeing in our climate model, which I caution is a low-resolution climate model by many standards, but essentially the picture is this, that we put the meltwater into the ocean, and that disrupts the ocean circulation close to the ice sheet. But that means that ocean circulation doesn't move the heat around the globe the way that it normally would. So when we think about sort of heat in the atmosphere, heat in the ocean, we can think of it as in this kind of constant state of flux, that heat is moving from one area to another, very much like traffic, you know, going around a roundabout or something like that. Now, as soon as you put a broken down truck in that roundabout, the flow of those cars, you know, it goes haywire, you know, and that's exactly what's happening in the ocean. We put in this melt, and then the ocean circulation kind of breaks down a little bit, or, you know, maybe that current that used to go from one place to another kind of diverts slightly, or it weakens, or it flows at a different depth. You know, these are all possible responses. And of course, the ocean is trading heat with the atmosphere. In some areas, it's taking it up. Some areas, it's releasing it. So that's why it impacts the atmosphere. The reason that we get this stop-start variability is because, you know, when it comes to the ice sheets, even though we're applying these gradual warmings, the way that the ice sheet responds is definitely not smooth and linear. The ice sheet has these episodic bursts where something happens and you get more discharge, and then it maybe finds a place where it can stabilize, so discharge slows down, and then we get more acceleration when it reaches another part of sort of ocean warming or whatever. So that means the input of melt to the oceans is also episodic, and so that gives you this stop-start in the ocean circulation and really disrupts the way that the atmospheric system responds to that.
That totally makes sense. I appreciate that. Now, we're starting to wrap up here, but I have another James Hansen quote, this time from the Independent newspaper in 2017. He said, "I don't think we're going to get 4 or 5 degrees this century because we get a cooling effect from the melting ice." Is it true that melting ice could slightly slow down global warming despite our greenhouse gas emissions?
Absolutely. And there was a paper in Nature last year by Ben Bronsalar and others where they highlighted basically the same effect that we talk about. And they were looking particularly at the impact of Antarctic ice sheet melt, whereas we've looked at Antarctic and Greenland. But yes, essentially what we find and what they find is that we might have an overall reduction in global warming under an RCP 8.5 type scenario of around 0.3 of a degree. So to put that in context, that's something a little less than 10%. So we might reduce the overall amount of warming by, you know, maybe 8% or something like that. The problem is that, of course, those changes will be spatially variable. So in some areas close to where the meltwater is going into the oceans, you'll see much larger reductions in air temperature or reduced warming, more to the point. Whereas in other areas, you'll see actually enhanced warming. And this comes back to what we were saying before about the disrupted ocean circulations. So one thing that we sort of tried to map out in the paper was just which areas were going to see enhanced warming and which areas would see slightly mollified warming. And yeah, I mean, it certainly gives you a very interesting sense of where the winners and losers are. And unfortunately, it looks like some of the enhanced warming would be around sort of eastern Canada, into the Arctic, a little bit in Central America because of the slowdown of the Gulf Stream. You know, a lot more of the heat is trapped down there. Northwest Europe would have slightly reduced warming because the heat transport across the North Atlantic basically reduces. So yeah, winners and losers. And, again, I would just say that this is one model simulation. And what we really need are, you know, lots more simulations that are doing this kind of thing to really refine our sense of where these extra warmings are going to be and where the reduced warmings are going to be.
Well, as we wrap up, can you just briefly give us a hint of what you might be working on next?
Well, what we're actively working on at the moment is trying to do a more robust job in terms of coupling our ice sheet simulations to climate models. So we made a start in this paper in terms of just sort of taking a two-way interaction between the ice sheet and the climate models. But we need to do that in a way that captures much shorter term changes. So rather than running one model, taking the outputs, putting them into another, running that model, and then kind of iterating like that, we need to be exchanging outputs from the two models, you know, much more frequently during the simulations. It's computationally a lot more intensive to do that. It's a lot more difficult to do it. It takes a bit of time to kind of get that right, but that's definitely where we need to go. And, you know, a lot of this comes back to the point that you raised earlier about, you know, what thing is driving what other thing. You know, we need to understand more fully how these different interactions work, how the feedbacks work. And really, you know, coupled models are the only way to do that.
Well, we'll send you a football-sized server farm and see what you can do with that. From the Antarctic Research Center at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, we've been speaking with Dr. Nicholas Golich. He's part of two papers just published in Nature. They are Revisiting Antarctic Ice Loss Due to Marine Ice Cliff Instability and global environmental consequences of 21st century ice sheet melt. You can find links to both and other supporting papers and articles, including Paul Beckwith's video on all this, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Nick, I know you've been swamped. Thank you for coming through for our Radio EcoShock listeners.
No problem at all. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Thank you for keeping up with the latest on Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about your world.